A word before we get started with today's episode of NTM Talk. While it may go without saying, it's important to remember that the views expressed in this podcast are the opinions of the participants and should not be construed as medical advice. If you have questions about your own diagnosis or treatment, please contact your medical provider. Hello, and welcome to another episode of NTM Talk, where we have in-depth discussions on non-tuberculous mycobacterial lung disease and bronchiectasis. I'm Dr. Colin Swenson.
And I'm Dr. Wendy Drummond.
And today we're going to answer your questions that you've submitted to us over the past 6 months or so. Wendy, the response from our listeners has been so deeply moving, don't you agree?
I do. I think you never have any idea what it's going to be like when you embark on this kind of adventure. And it's really exciting because it really seems like we're helping people. And we've had some amazing people reaching out to us. So we love getting the questions and your comments.
Yeah, and asking some really, really good questions. And so we just wanted to take a moment to thank everyone for trusting both Wendy and I with your stories, your challenges, and your wins. You've asked us so many good, tough questions that Wendy and I really wanted to share the answers that we've provided with you individually with the whole listening audience. And so that's why we're bringing you today's episode.
I agree with everything that you said. And what I would add to that is it's really an honor that you place your trust in us to send us your questions. We really value that. It means a lot to us. So thank you so much. And I will say that these are my favorite episodes. I love the Q&As. So hopefully we'll be doing a lot more of these.
We both love the Q&As. I think because it's kind of spontaneous, we get to sort of, you know, use the questions as jumping off points to start to talk about different topics.
Yeah, I think you and I generally like to chit chat. So it really, I think, is a great forum for us.
Yeah, we're a little coffee clutch, I believe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's a great segue into our first question from listener Jean, who asks us, I'm currently 4 months into treatment with the big three medications. So that's azithromycin, ethambutol, and rifampin. My doctor wants me to turn in sputum samples, but I just can't bring anything up. How often do we hear that?
All the time.
All the time. Do you have any suggestions for how to get up sputum? And if I can't get any, what then? Well, Jean, that is a really good question. And Wendy, even though Wendy is an infectious disease doctor and I'm a pulmonologist, I think that we're both probably of the same mindset here. Of course, I don't want to put words in Wendy's mouth, but here goes. I am a big proponent of induced sputum with hypertonic sodium chloride. And so my feeling is if you're on airway clearance with the hypertonic sodium chloride, especially if it's with a device, whether that be the aerobica or the acapella or let's say high frequency chest wall oscillation like the smart vest or whatever device you're using, chances are you're going to bring up some sputum. It may not be the dark stuff. It may not be particularly infected looking. It may just be thick and clear. We can still use that. We can still culture it. As long as it's coming from the lower airways, we can definitely use that sputum. We generally tell people first thing in the morning is best. So most people, when they sleep, when they lie down, gravity sort of works to settle those secretions from the small airways down into the main airway. And then first thing in the morning, when we wake up, we generally sort of give a cough or two, clear our throats and swallow it down. That sputum is probably the best to turn in for a sample. And so I would tell you just make sure to keep your specimen container, your sputum cup, right by the bedside on the nightstand. Grab it when you wake up and try it then. The other thing I will tell you is take advantage of other respiratory viruses. So whether it be, you know, the common cold, whether it be the flu, everybody develops a cough. Usually that cough is sputum when you get a viral infection. You can absolutely turn in that sputum. It's still going to give us the answer.
I agree with everything that Colin said, of course.
Yay!
I just have a few other comments to add. I think so a lot of people sort of forget that they can use their airway clearance regime as a means to induce their own sputum. So 100% what Colin said. One thing that I would add to that is that although we do prefer the morning sputums, I have some patients who say no can do. the afternoon is better for me. And guess what? Colin and I think that's fantastic, and go ahead and obtain that afternoon sputum. You know, especially, you know, a lot of our patients are already in the category of that dry bronchiectatic, where maybe they're not particularly productive of their sputum, either with their bronchiectasis or even when they have superimposed MAC lung disease. So those patients are problematic, or may, they're not problematic, but may have problems from the beginning in terms of inducing their own sputums at home. The other alternative is if you're not able to do a home sputum induction, it can also be done through respiratory therapy. And some of my patients, I just send them over to the hospital if they're somewhere convenient where you have respiratory therapy staff, and they can use like a 10% hypertonic saline.
Yeah, the super strong stuff.
Most of my patients at home are using either 3% or 7%, but you can go to the hospital and they can use 10%, which is a little bit more irritating, but that irritation is fairly transient. So that's another alternative. I think the question we hear a lot is, do I need to have a bronchoscopy done if I'm not able to submit a sputum sample? In my response, and I'll be interested to hear how Colin addresses this, but I don't generally send my patients for bronchoscopy during treatment for MAC if they can't induce at home. I'll send them to the hospital for induction, you know, by respiratory therapy. And even if they can't induce in that setting, I'm not necessarily going to send you for an additional procedure just to obtain sputum. So, you know, at that point, when you think about how do we assess treatment response in our patients, you know, we're really looking at three major factors. We're looking at clinical response, which in my mind is one of the most important factors, i.e., are you feeling better on treatment? Radiographic improvement. Sometimes we see that. Most of the time we do. And that's certainly a reassuring finding. And then we want, you know, we like to document sputum conversion to negative, but sometimes it's very difficult to obtain a sputum, and I won't necessarily send someone for a procedure for that. I'll give patients multiple sputum cups to have at home. And then just a little reminder to refrigerate it before you submit it to the lab if you can't submit it, you know, till the following day.
I think we're pretty much of one mind on that front, as usual, Wendy. but I do think that there is a role for bronchoscopy. There is a role for bronchoscopy in the dry bronchiectatic who absolutely is not able to bring up any sputum, particularly if he or she really wants to have an answer before completing treatment, or if the symptoms are not remitting or they're not getting a lot better. There's not radiographic improvement, then I think, you know, that's a discussion, an informed discussion that should be had with the patient and sort of made together.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you that in that patient population, if they're not clinically improving, they don't have radiographic improvement, and we can't obtain a sputum, then certainly I think a bronchoscopy would be warranted. And especially if they have new nodules or cavitary disease, they may need transbronchial biopsies. I mean, there might be a lot of reasons for that.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a really good segue to our next question from listener Robin, who asked us, I've been on MAC treatment for over a year now, but my bronchoscopy cultures are still positive. I've been on a 3 times per week regimen, and my doctor now wants me to convert it to daily. Will this work? Is there anything else that you can suggest?
Okay, I'll take this one.
Please do.
This is a great question. I have a feeling there's probably a lot of people out there asking about this. So there's a number of different features to this or aspects to this question that I think we need to address. And first of all, thinking about this thrice weekly schedule. So that's certainly an acceptable plan in patients who have mild fibronodular disease at the time of diagnosis. And I would also follow that up by saying on the milder end of the symptom spectrum as well. That's certainly a reasonable treatment approach. In patients who have more advanced radiographic findings and or more severe symptoms, then I, you know, typically we recommend starting daily therapy. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing is that, and we've talked about this in prior episodes, is that the 6-month time frame after initiating therapy is a really important time point, because at that time frame, and this is also backed up by the NTM treatment guidelines that came out in July of 2020, you know, if you still have a positive culture at 6 months into treatment on a standard 3-drug regimen. And we feel confident that the medications are being taken correctly, that our patients are absorbing those medications well, and the cultures are still positive. Then at that point, we really want to consider the addition of Arikayce, which is the liposomal form of amikacin, as an addition to the treatment, not in lieu of the therapeutic regimen that they're already on, but as an additional antibiotic. And so this is really a main time frame that we do that at 6 months. And it may be something to discuss with your physician about the availability of this medication. And not only that, that it is actually outlined in the treatment guidelines as an option at 6 months.
Totally agree with you, Wendy. I have a number of patients referred to me or clinicians who reach out to me from the community asking, look, if my patient is on a 3 times per week regimen, if they're not converting their sputum, should I switch them to a daily regimen? And will that improve my chances of clearing the infection? And the answer really is probably not. If they've not cleared their sputum by 6 months, they're probably not going to do it. So we really urge sort of changing the regimen at that point, or adding on to the regimen, I should say, at that point. And as Wendy says, you know, amikacin liposome inhalation or Arikayce is probably the best option because, number one, it's in the 2020 guidelines, and number two, it's the only FDA-approved medication for refractory MAC. So both of those being good reasons to embark on that treatment. The other thing is, as Wendy mentioned, the thrice-weekly regimen, and I'm going to say it again, is really, because I think it's important and it bears repeating, is really for that mild nodular bronchiectatic sort of phenotype. It's not for somebody with more advanced disease. That should be a daily regimen from the get-go. So Robin, I would say, without knowing the particulars of your case, without looking at your films, I think that that's a really, take our advice, have the difficult conversation with your provider and see if, you know, perhaps adding another medication as opposed to going to a daily regimen would be worthwhile. Stacy sent us a couple of really good questions. The first one is she says that MAC often recurs. After a first treatment with the big three, meaning azithromycin, ethambutol, and rifampin, and then a recurrence is found, is the same treatment less effective the second time around? And Wendy, I'm gonna defer to you on this one as an infectious disease expert.
Sure. So this is another fantastic question. So first thing I would say is, you know, I'm assuming that when we talk about recurrence, that it's true clinical recurrence where patient has new symptoms, progression on the CT scan, and multiple positive sputums, just to sort of review those, our guidelines that we follow in terms of identifying a patient who needs treatment. The other thing is I always touch base with my patient if there is a concern for recurrence and make sure that they're still on an optimal airway clearance regimen, because sometimes patients are feeling so much better after they're treated. They were being very compliant with their airway clearance program to treat their bronchiectasis. And then it's just human nature, is that people can fall off and not be as diligent over time. And a lot of times that's driven by the fact that they're feeling so well. So I always circle back around with my patients and make sure, hey, are you still using your aerobica? Are you still using your hypertonic saline? You know, what are you doing for your airway clearance regimen? Because that can be a reason why they have symptomatic worsening. Sometimes we'll see more mucus plugging on the CT scan. You know, there can be some more subtle things that need to be teased out before we call it a true recurrence. And then the other issue is in patients who may be predisposed to an underlying pulmonary aspiration syndrome, whether it's through like a deranged swallowing mechanism or recurrent high-grade reflux. Those patients don't necessarily have recurrence in the true sense. They may have a positive culture sporadically because they've reintroduced pathogens into their airways. They may even have a transient new onset symptom. So it's really important to explore those nuances. Now, back to Stacy's question, where we're assuming that this is a true recurrence, that the question was about the treatment. Is the same treatment less effective the same time around? And so when we approach these cases, once again, we're obtaining new sputum samples, and we'll will obtain susceptibility results on the new Mycobacterium intracellulari. And one of the things that we do is we always look at macrolide susceptibilities, and macrolide is azithromycin, and ensure that that medication is still active. Now, the vast majority of the time, it will be. It'll still be active against the mycobacteria. It's pretty unusual, truly, to see macrolide resistance unless there have been certain pressures where maybe someone has had several rounds of macrolides for a bronchiectasis exacerbation. And we've talked about this in the past, where azithromycin or clarithromycin are really not the best medications to use in patients with bronchiectasis at risk for exacerbations, because that can be a setup for developing macrolide resistance, in which case, you know, you're losing your backbone of treatment if you do need a treatment down the road. So we'll have our susceptibility results, but generally speaking, the same regimen, if it was azithromycin, ethambutol, and rifampin, would still be expected to be just as effective the second time around as the first time around, assuming that you've got good susceptibility results on which to base your treatment, which we typically do.
See, there's a reason I wanted you to answer the question. You did it so well.
Ah.
Well, I really have very little to add, except what do you think about, the terms reinfection versus relapsed disease?
I think I love that you brought that up. And this is something that I always talk to with my fellows about.
I realize it's sort of a technical term, but every now and then I will get a patient in clinic who will, refer to reinfection versus relapse, and they'll have that question. And so I think it's sort of valuable to bring it up.
Oh, I think it's a really intelligent question. Actually, I think it's a brilliant question, to tell you the truth.
Never been accused of that before.
Well, here's the thing. Infection is the presence of the pathogen being at a clinical site where it's not expected, right? So where you may identify a pathogen in what should be a normally a sterile space. Although with some of the more advanced testing modalities and DNA, we're able to identify bacteria that maybe have always lived in certain areas that we never really thought were there, but that's maybe I shouldn't have even said anything about that. But for example, you can have someone who will have a positive culture for Aspergillus. Okay. So let's say we're doing routine surveillance on a patient and we'll obtain a routine bacterial culture. We send off a sputum for AFB smear and stain. And I always send off a fungal culture. And let's say that we identify Aspergillus in a patient that I'm doing surveillance sputums for, someone who either had a history of MAC or maybe I'm treating them for MAC, but they're clinically feeling well and they have no progression on their CT scan. So that's an example of infection, i.e. the pathogen is present. Now, admittedly, I'm talking about a different pathogen here, talking about Aspergillus, but...
But a lot of our patients ask questions about that because it'll show up in their sputum.
Right. And if they'd had Aspergillus before, and maybe they'd been treated for it, but now we're finding it, but we don't actually correlate it with any active disease process or progression on the CT scan, it's not relapse and it's not disease. And so really, and I don't even usually use the word relapse with my patients or even... my trainees, I really talk more about infection versus disease, because a disease process is where the bacteria is, or the fungal pathogen, whatever it is that we're talking about, is actively causing that patient to manifest symptoms and or radiographic changes. I rarely have patients who may have a cavity, the bacteria or the fungal pathogen is present, but their symptoms are very mild. So, we've talked about this so often in our other episodes, but it bears repeating that there's a lot of nuances in the discussion with our patients, and just keeping in mind that we may talk about infection, but relapse in my mind really is speaking more to actual disease, where someone had a recurrence of the mycobacteria in their lungs that's causing symptoms and radiographic changes in addition to positive cultures.
Yeah. And I'm really glad, too, that you mentioned transient colonization, too. So I have a number of patients, and I think we've talked about this in past episodes as well, where, you know, they'll have negative sputums, they're on treatment, negative sputum, and then every now and then they'll have a positive. And it's just very, very disheartening for the patient because, you know, they feel like the treatment is not working. When in fact, you know, particularly if the patient has silent aspiration, nocturnal esophageal reflux with silent aspiration at night, sometimes you can introduce transient colonization to the airway. And so you can get a positive culture. It does not necessarily mean that treatment has failed. And that's important to keep in mind.
Well, and I have a patient recently who started using her humidifier again. And,
oh, dear.
Yep. And so it bears, this is another one that bears repeating.
Yes, here's a news flash to all of our listeners out there. Throw away your humidifiers, please.
Please, yes. These harbor mycobacteria.
And all so kinds just, of bacteria and fungus.
And all kinds, yeah, of, yeah. all kinds of things.
And injects it directly into the air.
And you're breathing it into your little vulnerable bronchiectatic airways.
Yes.
So I've had patients in the past where they popped a bunch of positive cultures. We did a little digging, went and had a facial. That's another one, blowing that in their face. But I've had a patient before where our main intervention was just stopping the use of the humidifier, and her sputums converted to negative because it really was reintroducing another environmental source for infection.
Yep.
So.
Now, Stacy also asked a really good question. In cases where your patients also have rheumatoid arthritis, do you find that treatment is more effective if they cease, at least temporarily, their biologic treatments? And by biologic treatment, she means the monthly infusions. Sometimes they're monthly, sometimes they're quarterly, such as Humira or Remicade, etc. And the answer to that, Stacy, is absolutely. So a lot of these biologics, some of them are better than others, and I think that's probably a topic for a whole other episode. But some of the biologics, particularly the anti-TNF alpha agonists, and again, they come under a lot of different brand names, so please do some research before embarking on that sort of treatment if you have a history of MAC or non-tuberculous mycobacterial infection, but they can certainly cause the NTM infection to come out of control and can make it very, very hard to eradicate. And so I generally advocate my patients with rheumatoid arthritis to find alternative treatment, and sometimes that requires some sleuthing on the part of both myself as well as the rheumatologist, a lot of conferencing to find an alternative treatment that does not make them so susceptible to NTM.
I just have a few qualifying statements about that. And I agree with 100% of what you said. But one of the things that I would mention too is that we really work closely with rheumatologists on these cases. And we have patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. So whether it's ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, who may be on Humira, for example. I mean, there's just such widespread use of the biologics that I've had some of them that I've had to look up in my office when someone shows up like, whoa, another new one. There was probably a commercial during the Super Bowl for that, but I didn't know. Anyway, but I digress. Yeah. Exactly. So my point is that, we're going to work very closely with the rheumatologist because I have had some patients, they have such severe rheumatoid arthritis and have really been on everything under the sun, and the only thing that's giving them any sort of relief is that biologic, right? So it can be hard to walk that back. And so my caveat in this discussion is just to highlight a couple of points. Number one, it's always evaluating how severe is the lung disease, right? Is this just mild fibrinodular MAC infection? It may be very possible. It's certainly plausible, and it certainly is possible to get patient through a treatment course. And I've done this many, many times. This is why I say this with confidence, that we can successfully get a patient through a treatment course and they can remain on their biologic. Okay. So that's one thing to consider, is how severe is the mycobacterial lung disease? Does that mean that you might need a longer treatment course? That's certainly possible. You know, we say 12 months beyond sputum conversion to negative, might that be 18 months? Can it often even be 2 years? Yes, it might mean a longer treatment course, but it's also balancing that with the quality of life and compelling reasons that may be there to continue that biologic. Now, there are certain mycobacterial infections, and I'm going to talk a little bit out of the pulmonary realm here for just a minute. Mycobacterium haemophilum being one of them for extrapulmonary disease, that you have to stop the biologic. Like, you are just never going to be able to cure the infections. Abscessus in the lungs might be really challenging to treat in someone who's on a biologic, although I have done it in patients with pulmonary disease and they've been on their biologic the whole time. But it's being having those good discussions with the rheumatologist, being very candid with the patient, saying this may take longer, or the IV component to your abscessus, your M. abscessus treatment, because we front load up front with 6 weeks of IV therapy, it might be 8, it might be 10. So there may be some caveats to the standard way we treat this. But once again, it's really discussing this with the pulmonologist and the rheumatologist and the infectious disease specialist in terms of how we address this. The other thing I did want to mention is that, and Colin and I am sure we'll talk more about this at the end of the episode, but we actually do have a dedicated episode. Right now it's episode 13, season 2. It's dedicated for NTM and immunosuppression. So we have an entire episode talking about the impact of steroids, oral steroids, inhaled steroids, biologics, all of these different things, or, you know, even in our patients with underlying malignancies. And so we will have a dedicated episode to that.
Absolutely. And that actually segues really nicely into the next question from a listener, Sherry, who asked us, I have ABPA, which is allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, getting back to the aspergillus. My doctor is treating me with prednisone. I also have MAC, and I'm worried about the prednisone making it worse. Do you have any suggestions? Well, Sherry, it sort of very similar to the last question. We do know that corticosteroids, of which prednisone is one of them, whether it's inhaled, whether it's systemic, it does make the NTM infection more difficult to eradicate. So if at all possible, what I do, and I treat quite a few patients with allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis who also have NTM lung disease. One case comes to mind, Mycobacterium kansasii. I generally try to avoid the prednisone if at all possible. Now, we can do that these days with the advent of other biologics, not necessarily immunosuppressives, but one that comes to mind is dupilumab or Dupixent. And I've had some very good luck, and you can certainly read some of the research papers out there on treating ABPA with this, and that in turn does not exacerbate the underlying NTM infection. So, and then there are, of course, you know, antifungals out there as well to consider, particularly oral antifungals like itraconazole or voriconazole that can also help in controlling the ABPA. So all this to say is if we can find a way to treat the ABPA without having to do immunosuppression with corticosteroids, that would be the best way to go.
Yes. And this is when I'm always so happy that I'm in a podcast with a pulmonologist, because I will say that ABPA is certainly more Colin's wheelhouse than mine, although because I've now seen so many patients in my clinic with ABPA, I think I've developed a pretty good working knowledge of the different therapeutics. And like Colin said, we really do try to limit steroids in that patient population, and largely because we have the ability to do so with these alternative therapies that patients do beautifully on. In speaking about the addition of antifungal therapy as part of adjunctive treatment for ABPA, one thing I want to be really clear about is that, and people always get caught up on this aspergillosis word, part of the ABPA. This is actually an allergic reaction to the fungal pathogen. It's not truly an infection creating a disease state.
Good point, Wendy.
Yeah,
good
and
point.
So when we... when we do add an antifungal medication like voriconazole, it actually helps decrease the amount of prednisone that we're using in these patients, and they tend to clinically feel better and allows us to use less prednisone. So it really has more to do with the drug interaction between those two medications as opposed to actively treating infection with an antifungal. And I just wanted to clarify that in case there are people out there with ABPA that aren't on voriconazole or itraconazole, and now you're worried that maybe you're not on appropriate treatment, and it's simply not the case. We don't necessarily always utilize antifungals in every patient.
No, we do not, especially as we have some of these more novel ways of treating it, whether it be, as I said, dupilumab or Dupixent, benralizumab, Fasenra, or mepolizumab, which of course is Nucala. So there are a number of other treatment options here. But all this to say is ABPA, I mean, I'm going to digress a little bit here. ABPA is oftentimes an unrecognized cause of bronchiectasis. And the type of bronchiectasis that it tends to create, unfortunately, is not sort of the mild cylindrical bronchiectasis, but it tends to cause what we call varicoid, and in some cases, cystic bronchiectasis. So it can be quite severe, and it's very preventable if it's recognized early and treated aggressively. And so, as part of the workup for the bronchiectasis, you always consider ABPA, particularly if the CAT scan has that pattern to it. And again, as Wendy mentioned, it's not an infection with the Aspergillus fungus. Aspergillus is something we call the fungus among us. It tends to be everywhere in the environment. Many of us breathe it in on a regular basis, and of course, it causes no harm. Harm causes an ABPA because you have an allergic response in your airway to the Aspergillus. That allergic reaction, in turn, causes damage to the airway that results in bronchiectasis. And so it's just a little bit of a teasing those two apart.
Yes, and thinking back to those characteristic CT scans, and this is experiential over time for sure, but patients with APPA, not only do they have that really impressive varicoid bronchiectasis, but they have a profound amount of mucus plugging. And it is an...
Oh, yes. And it's what we call, it's what we call high attenuation mucus, or HAM for short. It's almost like cement.
Oh, yes.
It is very, very thick, very difficult to remove.
And these patients really, and once again, I'm treading slightly into Colin's territory, but a lot of these patients really benefit from, I would say, therapeutic bronchoscopies, but that's, I guess, a whole nother discussion. Mm-hmm. One other thing I wanted to just discuss briefly, because she said, I also have MAC and I'm worried about the prednisone making it worse. Prednisone does cause relative immunosuppression. There's no doubt about it. I do not typically think of prednisone making MAC necessarily worse, but it's certainly not helping, right? So there are a lot of patients, and this is really speaking back to the rheumatoid arthritis question and the use of biologics. I have a lot of patients that have to be on prednisone for whatever their underlying pulmonary disease is, like bronchiectasis, but maybe there's something else. I'm not thinking about a good something else right now, but we just acknowledge, okay, this patient is going to have to be on some dose of prednisone throughout their entire treatment course of MAC, even though we do everything to try to attenuate the dose. And we can still effectively treat patients with MAC who are on prednisone. So I don't want people to think like, oh my God, this prednisone is like lighting a fire in my lungs with MAC.
No, especially if the patient is on treatment.
Yeah.
So if you're on treatment and you have to go on prednisone, we certainly, the patient population that we treat, Wendy, oftentimes is elderly, has underlying arthritis, or let's say spinal stenosis, needs to have steroid injections or go on a short course of corticosteroids, whether that be prednisone or methylprednisolone. If it's necessary, it is absolutely fine, and it's not going to undo your treatment. But it is something that, again, we prefer if there are alternative agents that you go on that.
Yep, exactly.
Well, this brings us to the end of the first half of our question and answers episode, but we look forward to answering the rest of the questions in next week's episode. Remember that if you have any questions about nontuberculous mycobacterial lung infection or bronchiectasis, you can always reach us via our website, ntmtalk.com, where you can also stream our past episodes and leave your comments. You can also find links to helpful resources on nontuberculous mycobacterial lung disease and bronchiectasis. We'd like to take a moment at this point to thank our sponsor, Insmed Pharmaceuticals, for their generous support of this podcast, and to you, our listeners, for your great questions and feedback. Please keep it coming. Well, until we meet again next week, everyone, stay well.